everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Retro Raw Rundown here on Inside the Ropes. It is late Sunday evening, early Monday morning. I hope you've had a good weekend. I hope you've got laid, ate nice food. And now you're listening to me and Sandra talk about 1999 WWF. Hi, Sandra. How are you?
Hi, Kenny. I mean, you know, after a weekend like you've just described, listening to us talk about 1999 WWF could be a letdown, could be the cherry on top of the sundae. I have no idea. This episode was weird, and I think my brain is broken, and so I don't even know how to start. How are you today? I mean, I had a pretty good day watching Chikara National Pro Wrestling Day today. Really enjoyed the show. Lots of cool things coming out of that. So,
excellent. Now, when am I watching the Chikara thing for our $50 podcast? When is that?
So I am not sure when they're going to release the remastered version of National Pro Wrestling Day, because today's was very much just like a live stream, like one hard cam shot. And I don't know if it would be the best version for you to see. So to be determined, but it'll happen soon.
So it's today's show that I'm watching?
Yes, probably.
Okay. I mean, that doesn't fill me with confidence how you said that, but okay, sure.
Yes, that is the plan as of now.
Yeah. So basically, for those of you who don't know, I've forgotten the name. I apologize, but somebody, some very patient person, had said, "I want a podcast of Sandra introducing Kenny to Chikara," and I've said for like a year, "I'll whatever you want me to do, let me do it." But the problem is, this person who listens to Sandra all the time seems to have had it not compute in their brain that this is a horrible idea to ask Sandra to like narrow down what to introduce me to in a short space of time.
It's like really impossible.
I think you secretly think, if I get this right, I think Kenny could like Chikara, but if I get it wrong, he will not like Chikara. So you feel pressure.
Pressure to introduce it to a larger audience. Like, I know that it's not going to necessarily be for you, and I'm not that worried about that.
That's a great start. The person that you're supposed to be introducing to, you're like, I don't care if you like it, as long as I introduce a good word for other people.
No, I think that you'll like it. I think you'll like it fine as a one-off. I don't think it's anything that you're going to be like, oh, wow, I'm so sold and I'm going to watch this every week. Like, that's not my goal. But I do want to be able to introduce it in a way that is, like, palatable and be able to explain a lot of the stuff, but also make it accessible to our listeners and try to introduce it to our larger audience as a whole. And the tough thing is trying to find, like, clips and narrow stuff down that people can watch from all sorts of, like, Chikaratopia content versus YouTube content versus like the show today. So like, we're going to watch the show that happened today, but I would rather wait for the remastered version so that it is a little bit more polished.
Sounds good to me. I had a good weekend. I've not said this actually. I should say it. I've not drank alcohol in February at all.
What?
So what happened was, in January, one of my friends did Dry January. And she banged on about it every opportunity that she was talking about it. I was like, oh my God, okay, fine, whatever. And then I, as a joke, said, oh, I could do a dry month. And everybody like laughed at me as if it would be like, oh, Kenny not having a drink. So I've just pretty much been doing it for 11 days and it's fine. It's dull. It's really dull, but it's fine. So like, I have, but so... You know, I don't usually tell the funny stories on here with you. So I should, right? Because you should get the
fun. You should. Yes, I agree.
So I was like, I'm just going to do it. Now, I am going to take a day off from it this week coming, because Steve Gunn's coming up. And I was like, we're going out to get pissed one night. Like, it's happening. So
it has to happen.
But I was like, I just want to, in my head, go, I can do this if I wanted to do it. So February the 1st, my friend, she's off Dry January, and we go to like an Italian restaurant in the West End just to kind of celebrate. You know, she's back on the wagon. Mm-hmm. She's on a wagon of some kind.
Off the wagon, I think. I don't know. Whatever the fun one is.
Whatever the fun one is, yeah. But what she didn't know was that was the day that I was going on the wagon. So
yes.
And I was like, look, I'm just gonna do it just to say that I've done it. And that's
well, if
fine.
You're gonna pick a month, February is the right one to do, right? It's a little shorter than the rest of the months.
Yeah, so like 2 days shorter. But like, so anyway, so we're in this bar and I'm like just drinking Coke Zero, and she's tanning the wine like there's no tomorrow, and I was fine. Like I wasn't like twitching to get a vodka or anything. It would have been nice, but I wasn't like dying for one. And then I'm looking at the menu, and there is and I never knew this existed. There is a non-alcoholic spirit, I'm going, what? I've never heard of this before. And it's called Seedlip. I'm going, right. Now, just to put the proportion of pricing here, if you were to get a pint of beer or lager in Glasgow, it's going to cost you between £4.50 and £5. That's roughly what you're going to pay. If you go anywhere more expensive, then it's too wanky. If you get a vodka, like a vodka and Diet Coke, it's going to cost you between about £3 and £4. That's roughly the gist. I remember when you could get a vodka for a pound, but that's, you know, I'm old. So, and this Seedlip is £7.45.
Damn, what is in it? Like actual unicorn tears?
And I'm like, well, wait a minute. They've found the cure, right? They've found alcohol in a non-alcoholic bottle. I'm all for trying this. So it was like, I'm going to actually try and find the description of it. ZZ's drink menu. Okay, ZZ's drinks menu. Because if I can find the... Okay, yes, here's the drink menu.
I'm very intrigued as to what this actually is. Because I've had a lot of different like craft like pops or sodas or whatever. I've had a lot of like just craft like cocktails that you could have without alcohol, I suppose. But like what makes this one so special?
Well, so let me find his wines. Okay, here we go. Seedlip non-alcoholic spirit. A non-alcoholic spirit distilled in the same way as gin for an aromatic and complex blend of allspice, berry, cardamom, bark, and citrus peel. Comes with cucumber, 50ml plus mixer. And it comes with a tonic. So I'm going, okay, I'm going to try it. Now, there's a bit of, like, tree in it, which I was told was rosemary. And I put the tonic in and I take a sip. It was like I'd taken a sip of a bath. It was fucking horrendous. £7.45.
Did it taste anything like gin?
No. And I hate gin anyway. But okay.
So you decided to order something that was supposed to be like gin.
Well, no. It was a spirit. Like, so I thought, well, you know, because if it's a really good gin with a flavored tonic, I can kind of get by. Like, I'm not loving it, but I can get by. So anyway, so over the last kind of couple of weeks, I've been having non-alcoholic ciders, non-alcoholic beers. Shout out to Heineken Blue, actually. Not bad.
Like, is it?
It tastes enough. It feels like you're drinking a Heineken. Kinda. Like,
and that's not always a compliment, but, you know.
But, like, compared to the other options that there are here.
Yes.
Copperberg ciders, the non-alcoholic ones taste exactly the same as the alcoholic ones, so I appreciate that. So anyway, why was I telling this story?
I don't know, because you're doing Dry February and it's just, it escalated.
But my whole thing has been like, I'm not going to go out and get drunk. So like yesterday I went out to watch the rugby and everybody's getting pissed and I'm just sitting there like drinking this non-alcoholic beer. Just going, what am I doing? What am I doing myself? So... But the thing is, I have done it. I'm 11 days in. I've not touched a drop of alcohol. Somebody offered me one and said I'll not tell anyone, and I was like, nope, I'm doing it.
Wow, so, that's impressive.
So, but I am totally taking a day off on the 14th and 15th. So, but what I've noticed is I've put on weight through not drinking. So why am I even doing this?
Is it because you're having more sugar?
I think because so instead of having like a vodka Diet Coke, if I have a cider. A cider is like packed with sugar. It's like 250 calories in it and stuff. And then also when you don't drink, then you might eat more because you're like, well,
that's true.
Instead, you know, if you have three vodka and Diet Cokes, it's what, 100 calories maybe tops. Whereas, I mean, in the time I could have three vodkas, that's a lot of crisps and chocolate.
Yeah, so that is true. See, I just like beer too much. Like that's my problem is I don't like drinking liquor as much as I used to. I mean, I still drink liquor plenty, but
WrestleMania 34.
Oh, WrestleMania 34. That is not happening again this year. WrestleMania 34 is one of the reasons I don't drink as much liquor as I used to, because sometimes if I start liquor too hard and too fast, then I'm like, oh, having more of it is always a great idea. And if it's right in front of me, I'm like, yes, please, let's have some more. I can pace myself a little bit better with beer and I don't feel as ill in the morning if I just have beer. So yeah, the whole like calorie cutting thing just sort of flies right out the window because I like beer so much and there's so much good stuff here in Michigan.
So that's been our weekend. And also I saw a movie tonight that I would recommend to everybody called Can You Ever Forgive Me? Melissa McCarthy was in it and she plays a true story about a writer who is kind of down in her luck and ends up forging letters from famous people. And she ends up befriending this kind of really funny older gay guy called played by Richard E. Grant. It's very funny. So check
out. I finally saw Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse last week.
Oh, was it the animated one?
Yes.
Any good?
It's so good. I recommend it to everybody. Like, I mean, everyone has had glowing recommendations of this movie, and I can't believe it took me this long to see it. I've never been that much of a Spider-Man girl. Like, I mean, I like superheroes a lot, but I've always been, obviously, like, Superman's my guy, and, you know, DC has just always been kind of my thing. But the DC movies mostly suck right now. Yeah, like, I've loved the Marvel movies and kind of everything they've been doing, but Into the Spider-Verse was just, like, it was fun, it was an adventure, it was one of those movies, like, you know how a lot of times you go to see the, you know, Marvel movies that they're putting out now or the DC movies, and it's all like tied down in continuity and you have to see all of them and it's all callbacks to other films and half of it is setting up another movie and all that kind of stuff. And that kind of stuff is fun. It's fun to have in universe. But Into the Spider-Verse was just like a fun adventure that was self-contained with awesome characters that, even as someone who's not as familiar with Spider-Man, explained all of the characters well enough that I totally got what was going on. It was awesome. I can't recommend it enough. One of my very favorite movies I've seen this year.
There you go. Recommendations galore. So let's get into this absolutely bonkers episode of Monday Night Raw. Before we do, we always talk about the Sunday Night Heats. By the way, this week we will be recording the St. Valentine's Day Massacre review. I'm really looking forward to it. Should be a ton of fun. But we did talk about the Heats before these shows. So in the Heat before this show, oh good lord, it is like a trip into Vince Russo's brain. The corporation come out at the start with China with Vince and Shane on each arm, and Vince is dancing to his own music on the way to the ring. Sondra actually turned this on. Describe Vince's dancing for everybody.
I mean, Vince, it's kind of similar to if you saw Vince dance to Flash Funk's music, but elevated, because not only is he dancing and wanting to be a gangster in the whitest way possible, he's doing it to his own theme, so it's also full of self-bravado. So he's like, he's shaking his shoulders and he's swaggering like only Vince can. And then when it gets to the no chance, he starts like doing these odd hand motions and like getting into the ring to the beat of his theme, but badly because he's Vince McMahon and has no rhythm. It's the most amazing thing in the world. And China just kind of looks at him like, sure, why not? This is what you're doing.
Vince does cut a pretty good promo, though, where he kind of sets up that Austin's going to face Mankind on Raw and, you know, what's going to happen to St. Valentine's Day Massacre. So they always do a pretty good job on these shows of, like, if you're coming in and you don't really know the storylines, that the opening thing will kind of set you up to where everything is. But the rest of the show, my lord, you had draws coming out during the oddities against Too Much. And then in the end, DOA come out. So DOA are now with Too Much.
Are they? Mm-hmm. I fast forwarded through that part, sorry.
We get a Road Dogg and Al Snow vignette, or video package. Then Al Snow has a hardcore match with himself, where he wrestles himself and puts himself through a table. Then Val Venus is making out with Ken Shamrock backstage. Which leads us to The Godfather versus Ken Shamrock. I still
making out with Ryan Shamrock backstage.
Did I say Ken?
Yes.
Different show. Val Venus makes out with Ryan Shamrock backstage, and then we get The Godfather versus Ken Shamrock. It still cracks me up every single time we see The Godfather with friends graphic. It just makes me cackle.
The Godfather with friends. Did Al still have a hardcore match with himself on Heat as well?
Yes, he did. He did it on both shows.
Because I was like, I know that I fast-forwarded, because the amount of Heat that I watched Vince's dancing and then kind of zoned out through his promo a little bit because he was just talking for a long time. And then I saw in the description that Jacqueline versus Sable was going to happen, so I fast-forwarded straight to that. Why would Al Snow have two of these encounters?
He's trying to show you how hardcore he is.
Get to it.
But Ken Shamrock is about to win. He's about to set off the ankle lock when Val Venus interrupts in the Titantron and basically implies that he's getting a blowjob from Ryan. So Ken runs back, runs after him. He ends up dragging Val off Ryan. Then we get Luna versus Jacqueline. Luna's back. She has weird music. Luna and Jacqueline is not as good as I would hoped it would be, but it's better than anything Sable does, which is good. And the more important story of the match is really Shane McMahon burying Sable on commentary. And the Retro Heat podcast is up right now on Patreon, and Finn revealed on that podcast that at this point, WWF, Sable had basically revealed that she wanted out of her contract. She wanted to leave. Mark Merrill wanted out of his contract. So they were done with her by this point, really. But
it shows because they were brutal to her on commentary. And she doesn't handle it well either. Like, she is doing herself no favors on commentary here. But Shane McMahon is just, like, talking down to her, saying that she wouldn't be anywhere without his pops. I can't watch Heat because Shane McMahon says the word pops way too often. And it is so grating to my brain. but, like, I mean, he's just brutal to her. He's so mean. I mean, he's, like, prime... you know, when JBL is bullying someone on commentary, or like when Corey Graves gets really, really ahead of himself and obnoxious lately, it was basically like that to Sable, who cannot speak or hold her own on commentary and is not a dynamic enough character to carry the segment. So she just kind of comes across as whiny. She's just kind of like, well, I think that I've worked really hard. And she's like, you haven't worked hard. You haven't done anything. She's just like, well, Shane, I mean, like, I just don't see it that way.
Riveting television.
It's terrible. But I thought Jacqueline versus Luna, like, it wasn't great or amazing in terms of like the kind of wrestling we see nowadays, but you can see that it has a lot more promise than anything Sable's going to be doing. And it's just a bummer. Like, I would rather these two women be fighting for the title instead of, you know, Sable just being this albatross of a division that was built to, you know, elevate her for some reason. The whole women's division thing makes me insane right now.
The main event is actually pretty fun. Mark Henry and D'Lo against Triple H and X-Pac and Owen Hart and Jeff Jarrett, which we only find out it's an elimination match during the match because Jarrett hits D'Lo with something, then X-Pac gets the pin, and then we're like, oh, this match is still going on, and Mark Henry and D'Lo
are still happening.
Cool, okay. China comes down, though, and then it ends up, in the end, China, of course, gets involved. Low blows Triple H, which allows Owen to get the pin, so Owen and Jeff get the victory. I mean, the thing is, like, whenever Finn and I watch these episodes, they're not, like, boring episodes at all. There's just, like so much happens in the episodes. I mean, this is actually quite a quiet episode in comparison, because there's only, like, one, two, four matches. Like, there's some weeks where there are six matches.
Which is crazy.
In a 45-minute show. But, again, this is, like, this is the era where they are just, they're everything they're doing is... it turns to gold for whatever reason. So it's like Jim Cornette said that famous thing about, you know, if you're hot, you can fuck a donkey in the ring and they're still gonna like it. But that leads us to this Raw, not fucking a donkey in a ring, but so this Raw in the Sky Dome in Toronto, at this point it drew the largest crowd in the history of the Monday Night Wars. There was 41,432 fans in the building, according to the Observer. 38,661 paid for a $1,134,813 gate, Canadian, and it was the third largest crowd. The third largest crowd and third largest gate for pro wrestling ever in Canada, behind the Paul Orndorff Hulk Hogan match from 1985 for the big event, and the April 1st, 1990 WrestleMania 6 with Hogan and Warrior. So
I was going to ask how it compared to WrestleMania 6, actually, because that was also in the Sky Dome, correct?
Yes, yeah, so in WrestleMania 6 drew 64,287. So
I mean, that's pretty crazy, though, for just an episode of Monday Night Raw versus a WrestleMania, you know? Like, it's crazy that they were able to draw this many people for just an episode of Raw, and not even a very good episode of Raw.
No, I mean, the thing, so I always can remember, like, I associate this episode of Raw as being bad. Like, I always, because the kind of famous image, I don't know if you noticed that it's a famous image, the one at the end where Austin's on the ground and Vince is kind of, like, jaw-jacking his face. Well, that's a really famous image.
I don't know. I think maybe I've just seen so many confrontations with them now.
That it kind of all blends into one. Yeah.
It all kind of blends into one. So it didn't, like, occur to me that that was a specific famous image in the way that, you know, some things that we watch, I go, oh, this is that moment or whatever. Yeah, yeah. Like, there's one coming at St. Valentine's Day Massacre that I know about that is a very iconic moment in the history of WWF.
Because that moment where Vince is kind of jaw-jacking Austin, that was the cover of a Raw magazine. That was the cover of the Austin McMahon video. So
okay.
But what was interesting to me was the crowd at points were really into, like, when The Rock came out, they were super into it. When Austin came out, they were super into it. But the crowd were not into this show at all. And they were not into it in a way that they were not into it before stuff even happened. Mm-hmm. Like, which I thought was weird because WWF was so hot at this point. Canada's such a good territory. Apparently, Dave Meltzer had said that there was a lot of fights that broke out in the building.
Oh, really? Just between audience members?
Yep, just between audience members. And for the last 45 minutes, fans kept pelting the ring with garbage.
Wow. I mean, like, I don't think this was a good episode of Raw. Spoiler alert. Like, I don't think it was. But it is interesting that that many people would pay to go and see a wrestling show and then not appear to want to be at a wrestling show. Maybe it just says something about how pervasive wrestling was in pop culture at the time that, oh, the wrestling is coming to the Sky Dome. We should be there because that should be a thing that we're, you know, in the building for if it's coming to our big iconic venue. But maybe they just kind of were casual people. I mean, like, even nowadays when you go to Raw, sometimes it's people who barely even watch the shows on TV. They're just kind of there because it's an event that's happening in town. You know, I've sat next to those
Yeah.
types of people at Raws, and it's not always very fun.
Well,
Like,
we should also say Austin Mankind was the advertised main event. It was a pretty big match, and we didn't get it. So, I
that's
mean,
true.
I don't know if that's part of it. Before the show, the Canadian version, Jason Sensation was on it,
Great.
doing imitations of people, including China, which I'm desperate to hear what that sounded like.
Oh, wow. Is that like videoed anywhere?
I'm reading about it here, but I've never seen it.
Okay.
Apparently, because this went out live in Canada on TSN, but everywhere else was taped. So, but apparently in the live version, Errol Hebner is getting like huge "You screwed Brett" chants whenever he's out.
Okay. Well, I
So,
mean, they had that later on in the show during the gauntlet clusterfuck at the end.
yep. So if you hear it on this episode, this is it drowned out. Like, by this is them getting rid of it. So imagine what it was
Wow.
like on the live version when they didn't have the chance to edit it. So,
That's one of those things that would be fascinating to watch, like as a comparison.
So let's get through it. So it was, as I say, this was Raw Saturday night in the States, and regular Raw in Canada, and Friday night for
Why
the
was it
UK.
Raw Saturday night?
It was preempted by the Westminster Dog Show.
Oh, it was a dog show episode. Okay.
Fucking dogs, man.
You say fucking dogs. You,
Listen,
Mr. Dog Dad of the world.
I'm not gonna ask you to preempt Raw for Hulk. His shit can go on earlier.
It's true.
We get a
Just
bit.
make Raw a part of Hulk, or make Hulk a part of Raw. That could be incredible. I think there should be more dogs in wrestling. Like, Officer Magnum is always welcome in Chikara.
I mean, put it this way, if somebody said to me Hulk can be a character on a wrestling show, I would 100% allow it to happen.
Of course.
Anyway, so we get an opening video package of the Austin McMahon feud, sorry. It's Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler. It's the go home show for St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Austin comes out, he is massively over. He guarantees he's gonna shed Vince's blood on Sunday. Then Mankind walks out, he comes out and says that, he lets Austin know that it's Mankind he's going to be facing at WrestleMania after he retains the title on pay-per-view. Mankind adds that he looks forward to facing Austin tonight, per the orders of Vince. Then the corporation comes out to interrupt. The Rock, talks about how he's got this great chance to win the title back at St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Vince says that he's really confident that he's going to win at St. Valentine's Day Massacre, that he's going to ban every member of the corporation from ringside from interfering in his match with Austin. Vince then drives himself crazy, saying like, officials are gonna have to scrub Austin's guts off the cage,
I mean,
and
he's really leaning into the threatening to do a murder on live pay-per-view.
he yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, it's 1999. You've got to experiment. So,
It's going to be the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, and he really wants to be true to form. He's like, no, you're going to scrape your guts off the inside of the kid. I mean, it's like, it's a very visceral description that he's giving. Like, he's actually going to eviscerate. It's like when they said that they were going to dismember Shawn Michaels for some reason.
yeah, and then on Heat they were
Which
like
meant
going off
throwing
the
him on
air.
the hood of a car?
They were
Question mark.
going off the air, and Heat going, "Will Shawn get dismembered? No, he will
No, that will
not."
not happen.
But Vince ends up concluding the segment by saying that he's going to referee the Austin Mankind main event later in the show. Smart move to open with Austin and Mankind and Vince and the corporation, because that's your big angles with The Rock. The crowd seemed to lap this part of it up. I thought the opening segment was good. I think we, in hindsight, could probably just close the show here. It had probably been good, but
Yeah,
they did not.
probably.
Any
I
thoughts?
mean, yeah, the crowd is super into Austin. I don't know that Austin has really said anything new in a while. Like, obviously, he wants to get his hands on Vince McMahon. He wants to go to WrestleMania. I do find it interesting that they're still building Austin Mankind for WrestleMania at this point, like, because obviously Mankind is still the champion, which is it's one of those things that it's kind of almost hard for me to remember that Mankind is champion again because it just because I know what the WrestleMania match is. This is a blip that I did not expect in the twists and turns of storytelling. I think Mankind is great still. Like, I still love him, but it's hard for me to even really remember what he said. It just kind of seemed almost like more of the same, but it was good, like, in terms of their confrontation. And you can see that there's still kind of a respect between Mankind and Steve Austin. And I know that comes into play later in the episode, but you can tell that Mankind and Steve Austin don't really have a huge issue with one another at this point, right? Austin wants the title. Fine. Mankind is the champion. Fine. So they are going to fight because they both want this belt that's very, very important to them. That's the story. And I think it's interesting because we've never really seen Steve Austin respect anyone else on Retro Raw as much as we've seen him respect Mankind and work with Mankind. And I know that they're former tag team champions, you know, in another iteration with Dude Love and Steve Austin and whatnot. But I think the dynamic between Austin and Mankind, I do find very interesting. And then, of course, The Rock just coming to insert himself into everything with, like, what even is The Rock's look here? Like, he's wearing slacks and, like, a vest with no shirt, and his sideburns are just a thing. I mean, it is a look that The Rock is trying to pull off.
When he comes out later for the match with Steve Blackman, like, in my head, I'm just going, God, he's cool. Because if anybody else wore that, like, anybody else would look so stupid. And he does, but he somehow pulls it off.
It's almost like The Miz nowadays. Like, The Miz wears the most ridiculous things, and he does it to look outlandish and look ridiculous, but for some reason it just works because he's The Miz and he can dress like a shoe, as Dean Ambrose called him once. And it just, like, you know, this is what you're doing, right? And The Rock kind of has that aura. And I mean, The Rock here is definitely, like, we are into prime Rock territory where he is catchphrase after catchphrase after catchphrase, Rudy Poo, candy ass, millions and millions, all of it. Which is kind of, in my brain, just kind of triggers to turn off a little bit when The Rock speaks. But I don't want to diminish his charisma. He is very, very good here. And he's a prick, and I don't want him inserted into any of this. Like, it makes me still want to see Mankind versus Steve Austin at WrestleMania, actually.
We should mention that there was plans up until about February of, do they do a three-way or do they do a one-on-one?
That was going to be one of my questions, was what were the plans at this point? Because we know, I mean, spoilers, I guess, but if you don't know that it's Rock versus Austin at WrestleMania, then I don't really know what to tell you, because I know that and everyone knows that. But at this point, like, what was being reported? What did people know?
I mean, I don't know exactly when things changed, but I think the fact that Mankind still has the belt says that they're still pondering.
They're still figuring it out.
Because why would he still have it? You know, like, why would he have it at this point? It just seems too close. So
it's just kind of fascinating to watch this as we're watching right now on current Raw and SmackDown, the whole Becky Lynch versus Ronda Rousey situation with Charlotte just kind of looming in the background, because obviously, like, we know because of reports and things and everything being so widely accessible to us that the plans are for it to be a triple threat with Becky, Charlotte, and Ronda. And so it's interesting to think back in 1999, how much did people know about plans? How much was being reported? Was that, you know, how much was shifting and whatnot? There are so many parallels between 20 years that, like, there are always going to be parallels between different wrestling shows, but it's interesting to watch them both in the same time.
Well, I should just mention this, actually, because I was, as we're talking, I'm trying to just get some information, and it's reported here in The Observer on February 15th, 1999, the date for The Observer is always the week after when it actually comes out. So anyway, this one was released the week before Survivor Series Massacre, and it says this: it has been rumored that WrestleMania will wind up being some sort of a three-way deal with Austin, Rock, and Mankind for the title. The way it appears to be situated at this point, which of course can change, is probably for an Austin versus Mankind singles match, with the winner going on to face The Rock.
Okay.
So that's the plan, or one of the talking ideas. So I guess that kind of backs up a little bit what I was saying, is they are still thinking about it. So
because watching The Raw, like, if we didn't know what the WrestleMania main event was, I wouldn't be able to call it at this point, right? Like, I it's kind of the way we can't really call what's going to happen with Daniel Bryan this year. We can't really call what's going to happen with, you know, a bunch of people this year, because things are still up in the air and there are still so many moving pieces. And it feels like that's kind of where they were 20 years ago as well, is, you know, there are still so many moving pieces in the air, and they still kind of have to decide and solidify their plans, which is exciting, because that means that you kind of have to watch week to week, and you have to watch St. Valentine's Day Massacre to see, is The Rock going to beat Mankind for the title, or is Mankind going to retain and go to the main event of WrestleMania? Like, it's exciting. I kind of like the intrigue.
Also, just made me laugh, so I wanted to read it out. The Observer also had this: Rock has been wearing a shirt because he had surgery on his chest, apparently to remove the gynecomastia, Gynecomastia, and then in brackets, or bitch tit syndrome, as it's known in slang.
Bitch tit syndrome made the Observer.
Yep.
Wow.
Now, Sable's not on this show, right?
No, I don't believe so.
So I'll read this out as well, because this is also in the Observer, but Kev will clarify it better than I can. There's a lot of internal heat regarding Sable these days. Both Sable and Mark Merrill asked for their release from their newly signed contracts, but were turned down as WWF feels it's going to gain a ton of exposure from Sable's Playboy cover, which comes out in early March. Sable, and then I've showed you that clip of Sable, Deborah, and China before.
Yes, I have seen that. When did that take place?
A week before this week that we are on right now.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
And so he goes on to say,
that's interesting, because in that clip, China's talking about how she's going to fight all the men and she like is too good for the women's division, but China's had like not very many matches.
So he goes on to say, Sable, Deborah, and China were on a TSN show this past week, and somewhere in the debate, the working turned into a shoot and feelings on both sides were ruffled. I didn't see the show, so this is secondhand, but it went something like the host asking China why she wasn't women's champion. China said she wasn't interested in the title. I mean, you get, anyway, I'll put a thing up in the Facebook community so you can see it. But he goes on to say, a lot of the wrestlers are signed with China and were negative towards Sable, thinking she went over the line insinuating the drug issue with China in the segment. Sable
with the steroid issue?
So basically in this segment, China, Deborah, and Sable are all on this TV show. Somebody asks China, the host asks China, does she want to get the women's belt? And she kind of laughs it off, says, nah, you know, it would only take me a second to get it. And then Sable's like, you know, well, you're demeaning me. And then they kind of go back and forth, and like basically China insinuates that Sable's got breast implants, and then, oh no, China says she's stronger, and then Sable says, why are you stronger? What do you do to be stronger? And
she basically insinuates that China is on steroids or some sort of performance enhancing drugs, and China attacks Sable for having, you know, so much plastic surgery, and Sable's like, well, you've had more plastic, you know, surgery than I have, which, I mean, China calling Sable out for plastic surgery is a bit rich.
Like I said, I'll put it on the Facebook community as well, and I'll try and find it, see if I can put it in the description for this podcast as well, if you want to go check out the segment. It is fucking great, so I would recommend you go
and
watch
Deborah
it.
And Deborah just sits there like, I am not getting involved in this.
She is not. He goes on to say, Sable and Merrill have also made it clear that Sable didn't come to the WWF to be a wrestler and has never trained to be a wrestler. Apparently she received a ton of money from Playboy, which gives her some independence she didn't have before. I'd say it's a very good bet that Luna will be winning the title from Sable, although if it happens before Playboy has its run, you should come to the conclusion that things are in an even worse state. So things are bad right now.
It's so interesting to me, the whole Sable thing, because everyone talks about Sable and how over she was and how like important she was to WWF. And she was very over at one point, but she's really just kind of disappeared from consciousness because she's barely been on Raw. Like, she's been on Heat more than she's been on Raw. And I think she had a couple really good feuds and stuff. Like, she was over for, what, a year, maybe? And that's about it. Like, she's just kind of disappeared now, and she's still women's champion, but it's not an important focal point of the show, and they're definitely not doing a lot to elevate her or use her popularity. So it's just kind of interesting watching it back, because she doesn't seem like as big a deal as history paints her out to be.
Yeah, and also with Mark Merrill, I should say, he had his elbow scoped, and then WWF asked Mark Merrill to return and do a character, basically copying his old Johnny B. Bad character from WCW, but he was like a Little Richard, and he turned the idea down.
I mean, can you blame Mark Miro at this point? They have run him into the ground.
True. I should also mention with this episode that the Sky Dome show, with the photo of Austin McMahon from this show, the one I was telling you about, the big image, was a full cover tabloid cover on the next day's Toronto Sun.
Really?
So, anyway, so we, after the opening segment, we get Deborah lotioning her legs as Mark Henry watches by on a monitor.
He doesn't just watch on a monitor. He is petting the monitor. He is petting her leg on a monitor.
We've all been there, Sandra.
What even is happening? Why is there a monitor in her dressing room where she lotions her leg? And why is Mark Henry watching it and petting a television screen?
Ah, the 90s. So we get Owen Hart and Jeff Jarrett coming out with Deborah to take her. It's going to be D-Lo against Double J, but we end up getting Why am I calling him Double J? I think I've just got 2019 Jeff Jarrett stuck in my head. There's too many time frames.
There's like a weird time vortex going on around Jeff Jarrett right now. It's all very confusing.
We're supposed to get D'Lo versus Jeff Jarrett. Owen and Mark Henry are obviously there. Deborah's with Jarrett and Owen. D'Lo gets in the mic and says that he knows that Mark wants Deborah. I'm paraphrasing here. He knows that Mark wants Deborah, but don't worry. He's got something to like... Something to do like is something that he can taste or something. There was something about taste was going on, and then he says, "I have bought you something." So I'm sure he says something instead of someone.
I'm sure he says something. Yeah,
I've bought you something that is all yours, paid for, and out comes Ivory.
Because he says, like, you know, she'll do whatever you want, like right to your taste or something like that. And I was seriously thinking, oh, it's going to be a sex doll, because that has to be what he has purchased Mark Henry, because that is the only way that this description is in any way okay, because he is describing an object that he has bought for Mark Henry to stick his penis into, ostensibly, so that he will stop stalking Deborah.
So Ivory debuts.
As
a bot person. I'm just going to read what happens and then give me your thoughts. So she comes out. We then get D'Lo versus Jeff Jarrett. It goes about a minute because D'Lo ends up getting the sky high because Ivory and Deborah start having a cat fight at the end. So now I guess the sides are even. What do you make of this, and what do you make of the debut of Ivory to WWF?
Okay, so Ivory, who is a super talented wrestler, Ivory, who is so supremely talented, Ivory, who would be a breath of fresh air into a women's division that contains like two wrestlers at this point, right? It would be great to actually build a division around people who can wrestle and who are awesome. Ivory, who does not look very comfortable coming out in heels and a short dress and trying to be a sex object. Ivory, who this is just not who she is or what she does, has been purchased by D'Lo Brown. It doesn't even imply that he's hired her as an escort for the evening. He really says like he bought Mark Henry something. So he has purchased a human being basically so that Mark Henry can have another distraction who's at least on his side, because Mark Henry is so stupid that he keeps going after Deborah, who, you know, is using her sexual wiles to lure him into traps so that he loses matches, right? And, you know, Deborah is doing this of her own volition. I don't fault her for it. If she wants to, you know, be a sexy lady and use that to the advantage of her team, more power to her. She really enjoys her body and showing it off. Ivory does not look like she enjoys her body and showing it off in quite the same way that Deborah does. And it just seems like so incredibly baffling to me, because I know how good Ivory is and I know how great she's going to go on to be, that this is how you debut this woman. And like, and the whole thing was really awkwardly executed too. I don't think Ivory did all that well in this role, because it's not the role that she's meant to play. Like, she kind of like what wraps her scarf around Jeff Jarrett or something and distracts him, and like, I don't know, that the whole execution of the final, like the finish that D'Lo Brown hit on Jeff Jarrett was just like, it was really awkwardly done and just kind of underwhelming, and supposed to be the celebratory thing because, hey, look, we got a sexy distraction too, and it worked out for us. And if that happens on Sunday, then maybe we'll win the tag team titles. Because that's the thing, right? That they're facing each other for the tag team titles on Sunday at St. Valentine's Day Massacre. But it just, we'll go on with the Ryan Shamrock thing, but the show just kind of broke my brain in terms of how it presented women, because it drove me fucking insane. Like, I don't like the fact that the entire representation of women on the show essentially seems to be a prop for men's enjoyment. And it drives me crazy, and I'm not very happy about it at all.
Well, you know, it's funny. So I read an article yesterday about three characters who were in Friends in the 90s. And it was talking about how, like, Friends didn't have as diverse a cast that represented Manhattan as it should have, and blah, blah, blah. And it talked to, like, the guy who was Paolo, who was an Italian guy that groped Rachel, and he was talking, the actor was saying he didn't like how it made Italian people seem stereotypical, which, I'm sorry, buddy, you took the fucking gig. Fuck off.
Yeah, but there are a lot of actors who didn't have a lot of choice. I mean, it's the same reason that, you know, like, there are black wrestlers who were led to the ring in chains because that was the work they could get as a wrestler. Like, it's disgusting, and they
I don't think that saying that an Italian guy who lived in an apartment who was a bit of a sleazebag, is the same as a black man being led out in chains.
Like, no, it's not the same, but I'm just saying,
what
like...
I mean is, like, this guy, I just think coming out 25 years later being like, this was bullshit, we shouldn't have done it. At the end of the day, you shouldn't have done it. But my point was going to be, is that he said, he was talking about that, and then there was the actress, the African-American actress who played Charlie Ross's paleontologist girlfriend, and then Kathy, who was going out with Chandler, and they were all talking about, you know, how different things were in the 90s in terms of representation on TV and all that kind of stuff. And then Kathy had made a point by saying, I don't, or the woman who played Kathy had said, you know, I don't think the fight is us going back to the 90s and saying, well, you know, like the fight is now to make sure that sort of stuff doesn't happen now and that there is more diversification and all that kind of stuff. And it got me thinking, because usually I am like, look, the 90s was a different time, so I'm not going to get too worked up about how things are presented unless it's like really bad. And I don't remember the Ivory introduction being as bad as it is watching it now. Like, I like her, and I knew she was going to be introduced as D'Lo and Mark Henry's manager, but I did not remember her being introduced as, here is something I've paid for that will do what you want. And to hear that in 2019 is kind of rough. So even me, who most of the time will be like, you know, it was just of the time, I'm like, oh, I mean, it's bad. The Ivory thing is bad.
I think it's valid having the conversation that maybe of the time was trash, because I think, like, I mean, obviously we can't go back and fix Retro Raw, right? Like, that's, I agree with the woman who played Kathy in that. Like, we can't go back and say, oh, well, they should have done this, and that's not going to be my hill to die in. But I think examining the culture of Retro Raw and how problematic it was in so many ways, especially regarding its treatment of women, it's a valid conversation to have, because then you can compare it to nowadays, and you can compare it to, like, let's not ever make these mistakes again.
Well, you know, 100%. I'm just saying, I think anyone who has a brain can see that the representation of women is bad here. I don't think anyone's disagreeing with that. Do you know what I mean? I think the more of the disagreement is maybe some people just kind of go, you know, it doesn't get to me, but it is bad.
It just makes me sad for little girls who were wrestling fans in the 90s, because if this is what they had to watch. And I mean, I know people who were wrestling fans who are women and were wrestling fans in the 90s. And they were like, yeah, it was real frustrating. Like, there wasn't a lot to cling to. And if, you know, like, it's just a bummer. So I'm glad that things have progressed to where they are now.
And, you know, it's funny, if you, I mean, you can't now because the day's been, but I actually was quoted quite heavily, Sandra, in the Sunday Post, Scotland's national newspaper.
You said today, you were going to send me pictures of the article.
My phone lens is terrible, and I can't get a picture that's clear enough to send you the text, so I will need to get my flatmate to give me his phone tomorrow so I can do it then.
Okay, that would be lovely.
But listen, you should see me this article. I'm putting over women more than anything else I ever have in my life.
I'm so proud of you.
Almost like, shouldn't get involved. Anyway, so the... We move on from adults. It's a great place to be. We get Val Venus and Ryan Shamrock hanging out in one of the Skydome hotel rooms. Like, I can't believe there are hotel rooms attached to an arena where you can open your curtains and, like, you can see the arena. Like, they must have put a premium there on concert nights and stuff. Surely.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
That'd be great to just, like, order some room service and just, like, watch U2 or something.
Sure. Those rooms cannot be cheap.
No. So Val Venus and Ryan Shamrock are hanging out. We get a video package highlighting the Ken Shamrock and Val Venus feud. Kevin Kelly then interviews Ryan and Val. But before that goes anywhere, Ken...
You say that Kevin Kelly interviews Ryan and Val. Kevin Kelly interviews Val. Ryan Shamrock has said zero words.
True. But before it can go anywhere, Ken Shamrock comes out, tears Val Venus apart. Ryan, I mean, God bless her. I don't really know if she's emoting here.
Like, no.
Like later on in this show, is it this show or Heat? I watched the two in very quick succession. Hold on. Later on in this show, I'm like, every single one of the hoes showed more emotion in their face than Ryan Shamrock did.
Accurate.
And yep, her brother and the man she is fucking are in the ring fighting over her, and she cannot she can't sort of like get an expression together. So,
it's very similar to Mrs. Yamaguchi-san, who also could not really emote or be part of it. Like, I don't know where they're finding these actresses, but this is just not really her forte.
God bless her, though.
God bless her, though. This Ryan Shamrock story infuriates me on so many levels. I hate it with all of my brain and all of my heart. This, like, when they played the video package, right? Because they did Sister Act again, which showed like Ryan and Val, and it was, you know, like, oh, Val Venus is fucking Ken Shamrock's sister, and that's essentially the whole thing. Like, Val Venus purportedly produced this video to get at Ken Shamrock, right? It says starring Ken Shamrock's sister. It does not say that this pornographic film stars Ryan Shamrock, a woman with her own identity and personhood. No, it says starring Ken Shamrock's sister, which says all to me, Val Venus doesn't give a shit about Ryan Shamrock. He is using her as a prop to get at Ken Shamrock because reasons or something, and also sex. I don't understand. And so it's very frustrating to me that, you know, when you say that Kevin Kelly interviews Val Venus and Ryan Shamrock, no, Ryan Shamrock has gotten to say zero words. Now, I do not think that the actress playing Ryan Shamrock is going to be great at speaking. I don't think that would necessarily go very well. I don't think they necessarily chose the right person for this role. But it's very frustrating when you're telling this story. She is literally just a prop to be had to like be sexed by Val Venus and for Ken Shamrock to treat as his possession because she's his sister. Like, if Ryan Shamrock wants to have sex with Val Venus, why not? Like, he's a cretin of a human being. She should probably make better life choices. But if she wants to have sex with Val Venus, that's totally her right. She should absolutely be able to have sex with Val Venus. Maybe she just wants to get off. Maybe she's not looking for a relationship. It's fine. But Ken Shamrock is like, no, she's my sister and I own her. And she can't do what she wants. She can't be with any of the guys in the locker room because I own her and she needs to do what I say. No, you don't own Ryan's body, Ken Shamrock. She is her own person and can make her own decisions. Val Venus, if you're going to put a woman in a film, at least use her fucking name and not just Ken Shamrock's sister, because you're only doing this to get at Ken because she is a possession. I hate the way she is treated so much, and it makes me want to switch off Retro Raw. I hate the story. And Val Venus versus Ken Shamrock is a match that could be really good and I could look forward to, but because a woman being a prop is at the center of it, I can't get into it at all. The whole thing just makes me flames on the side of my face.
It's very understandable. Ryan Shamrock does stick around post this angle, if that helps.
We'll see if it helps or not. If she actually gets to be a
I
person,
mean,
that would be lovely.
she is dreadful and does not last long. But that has nothing to do with her being, she's just not a very good actress. It's
She's
really
just not a
different.
very good actress. And I mean, and that's another
The
criticism of the
worst
story is
thing.
like, where are they finding these women?
The worst thing is, I think at some point the actress who plays Ryan does have sex with Ken Shamrock in real life.
Well, I mean, they're not actually brother and sister.
I know, but that's all I see.
But
Anyway, up next we get
I mean,
Gil.
like, I mean, kids on the Brady Bunch dated and stuff too. It happens.
I'd just rather it didn't. It makes me feel better to watch Retro Raw and not think of them having sex.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is a weird sort of like incestuous possession tone to the whole thing too. I don't like any of it.
We get Goldberg against Goldust, non-title match, of course, because, you know, you need to keep beating Goldberg, but he's a champion.
Why the fuck is he a champion?
But the most interesting part of the match is that the Goldust kind of man that comes and delivers envelopes comes back, but he has blue flowers for Goldust. Goldberg tries a spear, which fails when he bounces off of Goldust, which was brilliant, to be fair. Goldust then hits the curtain call, but then a very scantily clad Blue Dust, aka Blue Meanie, appears in the Titantron, distracts Goldust.
He has like roses over his dick.
And that allows Goldberg to get his first win in the WWF. And then after the match, Goldust gets revenge on Goldberg with Shattered Dreams, and then the lights go out, and we come back. Goldust is covered in blue paint, so he's had a blue bath. And that is going to lead us to Sunday, where we get Goldust versus Blue Dust in a match. What are your thoughts, Sandra?
So, I mean, Goldberg is brilliant at being inept. Like, he is very good at being inept and uninteresting to the point where he's almost kind of interesting, but the whole overt presentation of Goldberg as being just like a way to mock Goldberg still just is kind of grating because it's a little too like out there in your face. We are writing in neon. We do not like Goldberg in WCW. Seriously. Like, it's a really funny joke, right? You're laughing, right? Not really. But the gold dust and blue dust thing actually I think is pretty funny. I kind of am into the Blue Meanie now. It occurred to me during this episode that Blue Meanie is essentially the Peter Petrelli of Retro Raw because he is stealing everyone's superpowers. He has absorbed the power of you know, being able to control the Tron and have music and do video packages like Goldust does, right? And he can make confetti fall and be, you know, he can be Blue Dust, and that's great. And now he has absorbed power from the Brood as well. Instead of a bloodbath, he's giving a blue bath. But I kind of like Blue Meanie as guy who absorbs all of everyone else's powers on Retro Raw. Like, I'm kind of waiting for him to get a ministry or have head again or something. Like, I kind of think if they lean into that with the Blue Meanie, it could actually be really fun. And again, I just marvel at the internal consistency of the storytelling between Goldust and Blue Dust, because I think it is one of the most consistent stories they've been telling on Retro Raw. I don't know who I'm necessarily supposed to cheer for. I think I'm supposed to cheer for Blue Dust, right? Because Goldust is a baddie. Question mark?
Yes, essentially that's what you're meant to believe right now.
Like, the alignments don't necessarily make me want to cheer for either man, but I guess because Blue Dust is fun and I'm supposed to not like Gold Dust because he stole head for no reason, then go Blue Dust. But I mean, I'm not really anticipating the match being a great classic between Gold Dust and Blue Dust. I feel like it could end up being dire, but the story is kind of fun, and if Blue Dust can continue to just kind of be, you know, a wonky character who steals everyone's powers, then I'm fine with it.
It's harmless. I mean, it's dreadful, but it's harmless. We get Errol Heppner speaking to Kevin Kelly, saying that no official will agree to referee the Ken Shamrock of Valvinus match, so if a referee can't be found, Shamrock will be forced to forfeit the title. I love this, because it's really fresh, and why would the referees want to put up with these two guys when Shamrock has got a history of battering referees? So it makes all the sense.
Yeah, that's true,
world.
Because he did like batter the referee in the segment earlier too. He just like punches him. So yeah, it's a good storytelling detail where he's like, yeah, no referee wants to put themselves in harm's way, and it makes sense because Ken Shamrock is mental,
and he's done it throughout his career in WWF. So it's
yeah,
it's a thing.
It's consistent.
Triple H and X-Pac come out to talk about the China challenge. Triple H decides the best method of promoting China is to talk about her lack of having balls and a dick, while X-Pac tells Kane that he's
throw
not fair.
Throw Triple H in the bin.
We should say that the night before in Heat, Vince McMahon said that he would not let China face Triple H because he knows that she would annihilate him. So it's going to be a tag match instead with X-Pac and Kane, which... trust me, it is better that it's a tag match. It really is.
It's better that it's a tag match. I'm fine with it being a tag match. I would just like to throw Triple H in the bin, because Triple H comes out here, seriously, and like his whole, if the story was that China turned on Triple H for money and Triple H was hurt by that and he, you know, was upset with China, he has a valid reason to be upset with China. But the way he has decided to express this is to just make penis jokes constantly. He's like, you don't have a bat and you don't have any balls. It's like, ha ha ha, you want to be a man, China? Well, you can't, because you don't have a penis or testicles, so you suck, because you're just a stupid woman with a vagina, and that's the worst thing to be in 1999. Throw him in the bin.
Road Dogg ends up saying he's going to stomp a mud hole in Al Snow,
and then wipe his ass clean with his foot or something. It's very weird. Like, it's very sexual.
But the best part is saved for the end, where Billy Gunn ends up saying, I don't have anything to do with some Valentine's Day Massacre, boys. I do. And then he takes off his jumper to reveal a referee shirt. He's going to be the referee for Ken Shamrock and Val Venus. And the crowd were super into it. So I like Billy Gunn being the referee for Shamrock and Val. It's a good storyline touch. So
I like him being the referee for, you know, the most awful story ever too. It's not even the most awful story. There are worse stories, but it's a bad one. Like, I like Billy Gunn as the ref. He had his Intercontinental title shenanigans with Ken Shamrock, so he has reason to be angry at Ken Shamrock, but he also has reason to be angry with Val Venus right now, because they've had that miscommunication and dissension where they've been fighting backstage. So it's interesting having him be the referee who has contention with both men. So it's not just like a special guest referee who is going to necessarily be on one person's side or the other. He actually could call things down the middle, and it's kind of a smart use if you don't have other plans for Billy Gunn on the pay-per-view, but you want to have him on the show because he's a star. I think it's a good use of Billy Gunn, and I think he's the one who comes across as the most sympathetic in this DX segment. Like, X-Pac speaking is just always a terrible idea. I think X-Pac in this story comes across as sympathetic until he opens his mouth and decides to speak with that grating tone and awful, awful words. So, yeah, Billy Gunn was definitely my favorite part of this segment. And him being the right one to watch the match, I just want to throw the whole thing in a fire.
Then we get the entrances for Austin versus Mankind. Everybody makes their entrance. Vince is out there. He is encouraging lots of violence from both men. He wants low blows and eye gouging and creative use of furniture. And Austin and Mankind.
The way he delivers those lines, though, he's like, and low blows are encouraged.
Yeah, he is tremendous here. But of course, Austin and Mankind see through Vince's ideas, and then Mankind shoves Socko down Vince's throat. Austin and Mankind then fight with the corporation, they clear house, and this leads to Vince coming out post-match announcing that Austin's going to have to run the corporate gauntlet later tonight. I thought the angle was pretty fun. Again, had the show finished here, it would have been better, but it kept going.
But it kept going for sure. I think Vince was brilliant here. I think his delivery was very, very good. But it cracks me up constantly that Vince McMahon is the worst at planning for possible danger. Like, he is very bad at executing these plans, right? Because the whole stipulation, the whole idea behind Austin McMahon at St. Valentine's Day Massacre is that Austin can't get his hands on Vince McMahon if he is not in a match, right? And so Vince McMahon being the referee for this is interesting because I was like, he's technically a part of the match. Like, could Austin beat him up if he's the referee? But I guess, like, there's probably some sort of stipulation where you can't put your hands on a referee. It can only be, like, if they're in a match with each other. That's probably what's in the contract, right? But Mankind and Vince McMahon are not exactly on good terms either. So, of course, I saw it coming a mile away that, no, like, Austin and McMahon, why would they fight here? Why wouldn't they just have Mankind batter Vince McMahon? Because that would be retribution, right? After all Vince McMahon has tried to do to Mankind and tried to, like, hold him down and tried to screw him and be a cult leader and, you know, manipulate his mind, Mankind's had enough of it. He's very sick of it. And so it made perfect sense that Mankind would also want to get his hands on Vince McMahon here. And it's smart using the contractual detail where Steve Austin's like, I'm not touching you. I'm not fucking up my contract, but there is someone else here who can. And so I thought that was really smart on the part of Austin and Mankind, and the camaraderie between the two of them is one of the parts of Retro Raw that I'm finding more interesting than I thought I would, because Steve Austin being kind of a loner all the time, you don't expect him to have an ally or to reach out to someone, and having him have kind of a pal, I think, is a very interesting dynamic for both of their characters.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point. And again, I just wish the show had ended here because
I mean, hard same.
There's a really good segment here and then kept going.
Well, and when they announced Austin Mankind already, like, so far before main event time, it seems weird that they would put that on in the middle of the show. Obviously, there was a reason for it. Not a good one. I don't agree with it. But yeah, it was what it was, I suppose.
We get the Godfather versus Viscera. We get Midian on commentary talking about he has an eyeball in a jar. Midian's quite funny in commentary. He just, like, says The Undertaker and then goes, I don't know if I'm supposed to say his name.
like, it's too hallowed and too sacred to actually say The Undertaker's name. But he's like a sweet little simpleton puppy who just wants to be liked by The Undertaker. And The Undertaker gave him this eye in a jar, and it's like his new favorite toy. And it gives him all, like, of his power or something.
You like Phineas Godwin. What's happened?
Well, he hasn't been wrestling, so that helps.
Viscera and Godfather is not very good.
They're very concerned with Viscera's eyes. Like, the fact that the man put in contacts has baffled Michael Cole on commentary. He does not understand how this could possibly work.
Well, I mean, you know, it was pre-internet, so it wasn't as obvious that you could just go and buy these, you know, contact lenses.
I just thought it was funny how overstated Michael Cole was at points during this show.
He's trying.
It's not even necessarily in a bad way. It's just like, he is getting into it, right? I mean, bless his heart.
Midian does run in after, like, a minute and a half. So, you know, Midian stopped this match. I'm a fan of him for that.
It did make me laugh because, you know, Godfather versus Viscera is bad. Like, it is a bad match. And shout out to the hoe who lost her shoe on the ramp. She rocked it. She went with it. She was like, I have lost my shoe. I will bend over sexily, retrieve my shoe, put my shoe back on, still walk to the ring, still completely doing her job. I hate the Godfather. I think his gimmick is trash, but bless that woman for being committed to what she was doing.
Oh, God, too good. Then we get Val Venus and Ken Shamrock fighting in the locker room until Billy Gunn tries to
Oh,
break
but it
up.
did make me laugh that Midian ran in, like, because Viscera falls down once in the match. So, like, you know, Godfather runs at him and Viscera takes one back bump and Midian's like, oh no, I must save my friend because he has fallen down once and that is just unacceptable.
He is a large man, you know?
He reminds me of a puppy who just doesn't understand when restraint is key.
We then get Val Venus and Ken Shamrock fighting in the locker room. Billy Gunn tries to break it up, then gets involved. And then
is this what could happen on Sunday? They could have a fight and Billy Gunn might have to break it up?
Now, DX and the Corporation do get involved. And it just at the end of it, I was like, okay, so Billy Gunn has pals. Ken Shamrock has pals. Val Venus has no pals.
Well, I wonder why. He's a cretin.
Up next, we get X-Pac coming out to face Kane.
He was pals with the Godfather for a minute.
I mean, it tells you all you need to know when the Godfather thinks better of hanging about with him.
Right.
The X-Pac takes on Kane. The match is fine. It's nothing special. Kane kind of dominates it. X-Pac starts to make a comeback. China then low blows him. 2-on-1 attack to X-Pac. Triple H makes the save. They clothesline Kane out of the ring, and then China's kind of like wants to take them on. And then as she goes off the ropes, Kane just kind of jilts her out of the ring so that she doesn't get in there. So we're kind of made... It's quite a clever ploy because it does mean that you wait to see DX get their hands on China or China get her hands on them until Sunday. So I get it. It made sense. And it was short and sweet. So this was fine.
It's fine. The unfortunate thing here is that it just really made me want to see China batter X-Pac and Triple H, which I don't believe is the takeaway that I'm supposed to get from the segment. The alignments are just completely wrong for me. I understand China's motivations and Triple H and X-Pac after their dire promos earlier in the night. I just want to see them get battered and thrown in a bin. So I want to see China beat them up. And it's obvious here, too, that like China is just not very like physically skilled in terms of wrestling. She moves
very
awkwardly.
Do you know my favorite
thing
that she does? What? Is when she kicks people, but she flails her arms.
Yes. Yep. It all looks very awkward, and I also question why China is out there wrestling in heels.
Listen, you got a style.
And she looks great. Like, I mean, more power to her for being able to do what she's doing in those heels, but I don't think they're conducive to like having a proper wrestling match. So I think that's part of the issue. I mean, I know later on Ivory goes on to wrestle in heels and Right to Censor and stuff. And I mean, like, that's hard to do. And it kind of frustrates me. I don't know if this was China's choice or if it was like, this is how you need to look. But if it wasn't her choice to wear that type of gear, like, it's kind of annoying that China just kind of feels like she's always being super over-sexualized still, even though she's supposed to be this like big, strong person who will batter you. And there's just kind of a disconnect there for me, I guess. But I mean, I think they're doing well to protect China still here. And I like China and Kane as a team, actually. I think they make a really interesting team in the Corporation because, you know, they both feel disenfranchised by certain people. And I mean, I still don't really understand why Kane would choose the Corporation over DX when DX offered him genuine friendship. But China and Kane together are an intriguing team for me. So that's kind of what I'm looking forward to is I just want China and Kane to like batter Triple H and X-Pac to death.
Then we see paramedics see Road Dogg out cold in the locker room with blood coming out of his ear. This leads to Al Snow warning us that, you know, warning Road Dogg that he's coming to St. Valentine's Day Massacre to win. He issues an open challenge, nobody comes out, so he fights himself. He blows a fire extinguisher up in his own face, moonsaults through a table. Then Bob Holly of the Job Squad comes out with a haircut, and he tries to help Al Snow. Al Snow keeps pushing him away, and then Bob snaps and they start having a brawl. So I should read out this part of the Observer, which will answer some questions. Because Road Dogg Al Snow does not happen at the pay-per-view.
Oh, it doesn't? Okay.
We get Al Snow versus Bob Holly. And here's what they say in the Observer. Road Dogg is expected to check into rehab this week. It looks like he'll be out through WrestleMania. It's no secret to anyone paying close attention to the flip side of all this current media situation is the drug issue is going to become a big thing before the year is out, if not before the summer. WWF did some drug testing over the past week, and Road Dogg went to management asking for help with his problems. His match with Al Snow for Valentine's Day Massacre is off, and the plan is to shoot some sort of angle to give Al a new opponent. Road Dogg suffered a scare in Madison Square Garden when the ring ropes were loose, and he took an unplanned bump over the top, landing in his head in a six-man tag with DX against The Undertaker and The Acolytes. His right arm went totally numb, and Taker brought him into the ring and immediately pinned him. They held up the show for 15 minutes, put him in a cervical collar, and rushed him to the hospital. Although he was out of the hospital later that evening, went to Toronto for TV, but only did an interview and was kept off wrestling because of the injury. So he is out for a little while.
Okay, so that makes this make a little bit more sense, but not a lot more sense, because Al Snow wrestling a hardcore match by himself is just kind of baffling. It seems like the kind of thing that I would either love or hate, depending on the execution. And the execution just came across as cringeworthy to me. I didn't realize he had done the same thing on Heat. That makes it even worse than like that he did this twice. I was going to say about Al Snow and Road Dogg, because I didn't know that the match didn't happen. Like, I don't really know who I'm supposed to root for between Al Snow and Road Dogg, because they both just kind of seem like assholes to each other. Like, they're kind of fighting for no reason, right? And I mean, they have a reason because they had like miscommunication and dissension and whatnot, but neither one of them comes across as super likable here. Al Snow kind of comes across as a dick too, if he's like attacking Road Dogg backstage and stuff. And I mean, this whole segment just, it kind of went on, and he's like shooting himself in the face with a fire extinguisher and going through a table. And I can see he's trying, but it didn't really come across as funny or interesting to me. Maybe Al Snow just isn't like as interesting of a character to me as I wanted him to be. And then Bob Holly coming out to try and stop him didn't make any sense, because they're both in the job squad together. And like, I praised the internal consistency of the Blue Meanie stealing head from Goldust to return to Al Snow, because they're in the job squad together and that makes sense.
Well, no, this did make sense though, because Bob Holly comes out to help his friend and be like, what are you doing? Like, stop. And then Al Snow kept hitting Bob Holly or throwing him away. And eventually Bob Holly snapped.
I mean, I guess, but it makes Al Snow look just kind of stupid and unlikable to me, I guess.
I mean,
I thought that Al Snow was supposed to be a babyface, I guess, is kind of where I'm confused.
Okay.
Because
he once did have a mannequin head pinned by a bottle of Head and Shoulders.
True. And I thought that was pretty funny, actually. But
can we just say, Road Dogg, Bob Holly should be sending Road Dogg something in the mail. Because would his hardcore Holly run have started if Road Dogg had not been injured or needed to go away for a little while?
Probably not, no. So, I mean, I didn't realize that this was kind of what started the hardcore Holly thing either. It just kind of came out of nowhere, and I was more confused than interested, because I can't say that I'm all that intrigued by a Bob Holly versus Al Snow match on a show either. And I was still thinking that it was going to be like Road Dogg versus Al Snow. So I was like, what even is the point of this Bob Holly situation? Does he get involved or something? I don't know. The segment just didn't work for me. Like, sometimes these things work and sometimes they don't. And it just didn't really work for me all that much. And it just kind of makes Al Snow seem even dumber.
It'll be interesting to see how you feel about the match on Sunday. Mm-hmm. So then we get Kevin Kelly interviewing Draws. Draws wants to know why Kevin Kelly was calling him a punk on Sunday Night Heat. He then slaps Kevin Kelly. And then before he can do anything else, Steve Blackman tries to break it up with, you know, as you would expect, no charisma or interest.
He doesn't try to break it up. Steve Blackman wanders backstage, comes across the prone corpse of Kevin Kelly, looks baffled, sort of pokes him for a second to see if he's alive.
No, that's not what happens. Draws hits Kevin Kelly. Kevin Kelly falls to the ground, and then Steve Blackman shoves Draws out of the way.
Oh, he does? Does he shove him out of the way? Okay.
Shoves him out of the way, and then that's when Draws goes, because Steve Blackman basically tells him to go away, and then Draws is like, you know, you got a problem with me, and then that's it.
Oh, okay, gotcha. I just remember Steve Blackman like looking at Kevin Kelly and looking baffled and being like, what is going on here? Because he just wanders across situations, basically.
It also just shows you how impactful Steve Blackman is, that you've just watched this and you didn't get the segment.
I didn't get the segment. Well, it shows you how impactful Draws is, because the only thing I remember from this segment is Draws' big furry hat. And, like, I remember him hitting Kevin Kelly, because I just remember thinking, like, poor Kevin Kelly. He keeps putting himself out there for journalism and just getting hit for his troubles and, you know, possibly shot at for his troubles. And, like, Kevin Kelly for Hall of Fame. But Draws is awful. Like, he is very bad. And I don't even understand what his problem was here, because he's just like, you called me a punk and I'm sad about it. Okay, Draws, go in your corner.
You know, what's funny to me is that, you know, so you've got, the Rock's going to be having a match here, and Steve Blackman's music hits, and I swear to God, did the crowd know that Steve Blackman was coming out? Because there was no reaction of any kind. Anywhere in the arena of 40,000 people.
He's an enigma, isn't he? Like, I kind of love how inept Steve Blackman is. The thing is, when he wrestles, I don't think it's terrible. Like, I think he can do certain things athletically that are fine.
He's
but
in good shape.
He is in good shape, and I think, like, he kicks well and things, and, like, he has decent drop kick and whatnot.
But it's like, if you want The Rock to get booed, don't put him out there against Steve Blackman. Because
no, because nobody's going to care about Steve Blackman.
Well, also, it just felt like when The Rock came out, everyone was like, yes, a star! Great. Like, somebody we know.
Well, and the show has been kind of not great for the past few segments either, so it's not incredibly helpful. Yeah, The Rock versus Steve Blackman, I don't remember a ton about the match, if I'm being honest. It was fine, and it happened, and The Rock is a much bigger star than Steve Blackman, and no one is really in Steve Blackman's corner. I mean, bless Steve Blackman for trying to assist Kevin Kelly the way he did. Steve Blackman's graphic is my favorite thing, though, because he looks so confused in the graphic. Like, and he has his hands up like Alexis in Schitt's Creek when she's like, oh, David. Like, that's the pose that Steve Blackman is doing in his graphic.
Yes. but there's new Schitt's Creek. Can you watch it? Anyway.
Yeah, it's good.
So then it's main event time. It is the corporate gauntlet of Stone Cold Steve Austin going through. Shamrock's up first. He gets disqualified after Test interferes. Then Test gets disqualified. Then Kane gets disqualified. Then China gets disqualified. Then Bossman gets disqualified. And in the end, Vince McMahon walks into the ring, pins Stone Cold Steve Austin in the middle of the ring. 1, 2, 3.
Did Austin get hit with a nightstick or something?
Yes. So yeah.
Is that what happened?
Yeah, Austin hit with a nightstick. And then Vince pins him. 1, 2, 3. Then the corporation hold Austin in the corner as Vince screams at him as we go off the air. So, I mean, so Vince pins Austin. This is the first time Austin has been pinned since...
Was Mankind the last one to pin Austin?
Maybe?
Because I remember Mankind pinning Austin at some point.
Was it when Undertaker and Kane pinned him at the same time? At Breakdown?
I don't know.
Or how did he lose the Survivor Series? When he lost the Survivor Series on the tournament. I can't remember. Anyway,
I can't remember.
He very rarely gets pinned is the point, and he got pinned here. So, I get the angle they were going for. It's funny because it should be such a triumphant moment for them because they've got this big Raw in the Sky Dome and 40,000 people. What did you make of the main event segment?
I thought it was a clusterfuck. It was terrible. It was one of those things that could have been fun, I guess, but it just...
Good on paper?
Maybe good on paper, not good in execution. I can see what they were trying to do because they're trying to make Stone Cold Steve Austin look like a big threat, right? Which, you know, running a gauntlet is going to make someone look like a big threat. We've seen it work really well with people like Seth Rollins running a gauntlet and beating multiple people. But the fact that this gauntlet never had any real pinfalls or conclusions, it just kind of felt like an exercise in frustration because nothing ever got going. And it didn't make Austin look that triumphant because it was just like people kept attacking him. So he didn't beat anyone in this gauntlet the entire time. And that's fine. Like, Austin tends to be kind of almost too overpowered for me. Like, when he just comes out and stuns everyone and gets to stand tall over everyone and whatnot, like, that gets old after a little while. But this was almost the opposite of that, where if you want Stone Cold Steve Austin to look impressive and look dominant going into the pay-per-view, then this really wasn't the way to do it. And I don't think it did anything for the corporation either, because I feel like they did all of the disqualifications because they didn't want to have Austin be so overpowered and pin every member of the corporation. Cause what does that do for the corporation? Right? Like that would just make them look like punks. So instead it was just kind of one of those nothing things where they didn't commit to any sort of finish and no one really got any more over from it. And then Vince McMahon pinning Stone Cold Steve Austin is interesting from the standpoint that Austin let Vince pin him and that happened in the middle of the ring, but it just kind of fell flat for me because I was like, okay, well, he got hit by a nightstick and then Vince pins him. So we're supposed to believe that Vince is the most powerful person, apparently, because none of the other corporation members who are actually professional wrestlers could pin him. okay, fine. I mean, it didn't even really make me want to see Austin get his hands on Vince McMahon as much as I wanted it to make me want that. Like, other things that they've done in the past have been a lot more effective than this. It felt like an exercise and kind of nothing to me. And it should have been this big thing.
This is a thumbs down show for me. I thought it was a pretty poor go home show.
Yeah, thumbs down. It made me less interested in the pay-per-view, which is not helpful. I mean,
Most retro Raws don't tend to drag that much. Like, even if they're like not great, they don't tend. But this one dragged.
this one was kind of a slog.
I had to watch
And
this in two sittings.
did you? Because I mean, I had to watch it in one sitting because I was watching it, I mean, fairly late at night, but time was short. But I did turn it off in the middle for a little while because I just needed a break from it. And like, I didn't, I think I just paused for half an hour to, like, I don't know, go on social media or something because I just needed to rest my brain from all of the rage and boredom, which is not helpful. Like, I mean, I don't like being so down on an episode, but there was there were like a few fun things. Like, I thought that Mankind beating up Vince McMahon and whatnot, like, that was a segment that made me more intrigued for Stone Cold Steve Austin versus Vince McMahon, was the whole stuff where Mankind got to batter Vince and, Austin kind of got one up on him, and that was kind of cool. But I don't know, this just didn't work for me. And I thought it was weird that they had Austin run a gauntlet of corporation members when all of the corporation members are banned from the match at ringside. Like, they're banned from interfering, which leads me to believe that maybe there could be someone else who interferes in that match.
What I will say is that the card for St. Valentine's Day Massacre, well, most of it is pretty good. There's a couple, so we've got Goldust and Bluedust having a match. We're gonna have Midian
I want
versus.
shenanigans. I want powers. I want lights. I want all of the things.
We're gonna have Midian versus the Big Boss Man.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
But the rest of the card is pretty good. We've got Al Snow defending the Hardcore title. Well, not defending, sorry, because Road Dogg was the champion, so now it's
Because Road
four.
Dogg's the champion.
So it's for the vacant hardcore title, Al Snow versus Bob Holly. D'Lo and Mark Henry against Jeff and Owen for the tag titles. Got Val Venus versus Ken Shamrock with Billy Gunn as the referee. Corporation of China and Kane against DX. Mankind versus The Rock in a Last Man Standing match. And Austin versus Vince in the cage. So, should be a pretty good show. Enough on there to be interesting. I think it's a good show from what I remember, but we'll see. And then Finn and I will be reviewing Heat, where we get the Hardy Boys against Too Much, Test versus Viscera, and Billy Gunn versus Tiger Ali Singh.
Wow, that's going to be dire. You know what I'm not watching before I watch St. Valentine's Day Massacre? Heat. I am not watching this one.
Give us the plug, Sandra.
Okay, you can find me on Twitter at SandraRuthRW. Find Kenny on Twitter at KennyMC1985. Follow Inside the Ropes at Inside_the Ropes. Check us out on Patreon, patreon.com/InsideTheRopes. We'll be reviewing St. Valentine's Day Massacre on there in the coming few days. Tons of bonus content going up all the time. We'll have Elimination Chamber review up there next week as well. So good time to sign up for Patreon on the road to WrestleMania. Tons more stuff happening. YouTube.com/InsideTheRopes for tons of interview content. And go to insidetheropes.co.uk/Goldust for tickets to an evening with Goldust at the beginning of March.
And who's going to play us out this week?
I think we should play. Who do I not hate on this show? Can we play Mankind's theme just because I like it and he remains likable?
Sure. So it's time for us to play Mankind's theme. He will play us out, and we will be back next week with more. So thanks for listening, everybody. Bye.
Bye.